Your weekly podcast where we speak to the biggest newsmakers and news shapers in finance. I'm your host, Lisa Lee. This week, my guest is Lafi Karui, multi-asset credit strategist and co-head of client solutions and analytics at PIMCO, a fixed income specialist with more than $2 trillion in assets under management. When PIMCO speaks, markets listen. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you again.
It really is good to have you here. I want to discuss the big breaking news that's happened today. The last week, a couple of days actually, the U.S. has resumed bombing of Iran. Energy prices are up. We have the new Federal Reserve Chairman, Kevin Warsh, saying he is resolute commitment to ensure price stability. And we also have softer readings on inflation, consumer price index, and producer price index. So Lafri, when you feature all of these three things in, what is your thoughts about the macroeconomy and where we're headed?
Yeah, I know. I think unfortunately the news flow of the past couple of days kind of brings back that left tail that many people thought, you know, we got under control a little bit. But and you know, it's happening against a backdrop actually of pretty positive news on the inflation front. I mean, actually, since the last FOMC meeting, which, as you know, struck a pretty hawkish tone, the news flow in general on the inflation front has been quite positive. You got CPI last, you know, I guess earlier this week, PPI today, and everything seems to suggest that sort of the direction of travel as far as inflation goes is probably lower and a gradual return to the, hopefully, the Fed's sort of 2% target. There are events in the Middle East obviously complicate
right.
that a little
yes.
bit. And, you know, I usually say that, you know, oil supply shocks rarely age well. And so what you have to hope for is for some kind of resolution. I think on the positive side, you know, we entered the conflict with a level of excess inventory that was exceptionally high by historical standards. And I think that bought us quite a lot of time. But what you want is avoid a scenario in which actually the conflict sort of lingers and then the supply pressure kind of starts to choke economic activity, you know, a little bit. So what would I watch? Obviously, your 6-month, you know, crude oil futures, that's a key variable that I would keep an eye on. And then diesel is the other one because that's a key input that goes into economic activity. Actually, diesel over the past couple of days, you know, shot up quite meaningfully relative to oil.
Because I was going to say, oil prices haven't gone up that much, right? But you're saying watch diesel.
Oh yeah, and other inputs, you know, have responded, and that's the one thing that I would that I would watch.
But let's talk about the softer reading on PPI and CPI. Is that just one off in your estimation, or does this sort of portend that that the Federal Reserve has sort of inflation handled, at least without the oil shock?
I don't think it's a one-off. I think, look, I mean, you know, it's useful to sort of go back where we started the year. You know, you may remember the consensus view going into the year was that you got to get some reacceleration in growth, a deceleration in inflation, as many of the headwinds that actually did weigh on inflation back in 25 kind of start wearing off a little bit. Obviously, the war sort of delayed that, you know, a little bit. But I think a lot of what we're seeing is just structurally driven. I don't think these are, well, you know, one-offs, but the impact of tariffs should continue to fade.
Mm-hmm.
I think mechanically some of the increase in sort of AI type of inputs, whether it's chips and memories on a sequential basis, that should also, you know, start going down a little bit. And then you also have a labor market that's been showing remarkable stability, you know, without being, you know, nothing too spectacular. But I think that gives the Fed, you know, a pretty valuable degree of freedom here. And so I would say the direction of travel going forward is probably for a continued return or, a continued deceleration in inflation, hopefully back to that 2% target, which we haven't seen, by the way,
for five years, right? It's just been a really long time. Are we now just comfortable with a little slightly higher level of inflation? Or do you think, given what Warsh is saying, we're going to really try to get back to 2%?
I think, you know, your level of comfort really depends on one key parameter, which is inflation expectations. You can tolerate a little bit of a deviation from that 2% target as long as long-term inflation expectations remain anchored. And I think, you know, to your point about the last 5 years, yes, there's been a pretty material deviation from the Fed's target. But on the other hand, whether you look at survey-based measures of inflation expectations or market-based measures of inflation expectations, you know, people look at five-year forwards, those have actually remained remarkably well-behaved around sort of that 2% long-run level. And I think that tells you that the market really always gave the Fed the benefit of the doubt when it comes to its ability to return to that, 2% target. And the reality is, look, we also have to sort of understand why we've deviated, you know, for such a long time from that 2% target. I mean, it's been a series of rolling supply shocks that the Fed has nothing to do with. I mean, obviously, so COVID is a classic example of that. You can always make a case that we may have overstimulated a little bit. And so it's hard to kind of disentangle supply and demand, you know, dynamic. But then we had the Russia-Ukraine conflict. That's a pure supply shock. You had tariffs, and then you had the Middle East conflict. And so, you know, I think, you know, you sort of have to put things in context a little bit. But to me, the key variable is really inflation expectations. So far, you know, those have been very well behaved, very anchored around that sort of 2% long run target.
So I don't think anyone was expecting a cut in the July Fed meeting, FOMC meeting. Do you expect future rate hikes or rate cuts? Or do you think we just stay at this level, given what you just said right now?
It's always useful to start, with where the market is. Mm-hmm. The market is pricing in a little, something like a hike and a half, I think, you know, between now and the next 12 months. There's something that is always very important to keep in mind when you look at what the market is pricing in. That is a probability-weighted average of outcomes. Mm-hmm. It's not a modal case. But if you ask me about the modal case, the PIMCO view is that the Fed is the most likely outcome this year is that you'll have a Fed that is on hold. Okay. And I would say the conviction level in that view has only grown, given sort of the recent news flow on inflation. And so, yes, the market is a bit above that, but also you kind of have to interpret that a little bit carefully.
When do we really need to start worrying about energy? Because I have been talking to people such as like yourself since the Iran war started and even before. And they said, given the high level of inventories that we went into this war, and we're very fortunate in that, we could probably last till August, maybe September. We're fast approaching August and September.
That's a view that you hear from a lot of commodities mm-hmm. experts, that we do have enough to sort of continue to withstand or resist some of this until August, September. But I think the mechanics of it is what matters the most, which is ultimately energy supply shocks become problematic if the only way to resolve it is via demand destruction, mm-hmm. right? Because at the end of the day, you know, there's a finite amount of commodities that you can buy. And if prices kind of shoot up, you know, the only way to sort of rebalance the market is by reducing demand, you know, dramatically. And so I would start to become concerned once we see evidence of demand destruction, because that would automatically mm-hmm. mean that economic activity will slow down, and then you'll have to reprice, you know, the risk of a significant sort of declining growth or even like an outright recession, you know, globally. We're not there yet, but that's sort of the signal that I would be, you know, looking for. And then you're absolutely right. You know, luckily, you know, we went to do this with a pretty decent buffer from an excess inventory standpoint, but there's a limit to how much time that can buy you. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you do need that portion.
And the consumer seemed very resilient to higher energy prices, higher gas prices. To your point, they haven't pulled back on spending. Definitely businesses mm-hmm. have not pulled back on their spending or have an impact to their earnings. We just started corporate earnings, so maybe we could pivot to that. It's earnings season now. Some of the banks are putting in some amazing numbers. So it seems mm-hmm. at least the financial sector is very healthy. Can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing so far in the earnings seasons? I know it's very early. And also what you've mentioned before, which I thought was interesting, is the expectation for higher EBITDA. Why is this happening and how does it impact the way you view this earnings season?
Yeah, I mean, that's been definitely the major theme in this first half of the year, which is the magnitude of earnings revisions has been really, really impressive. And in fact, I think, if you look at the performance of the S&P 500 year to date, the vast majority of your sort of cumulative return has actually come from earnings revision. And so this idea that we're sort of in bubble territory is not really validated. I mean, you just reprice better earnings growth running going forward. Now, the flip side of that is that that probably means that the bar becomes higher and higher to actually beat expectations.
And on top of this, we have what some are calling the biggest revolution of our lifetime, right? Perhaps multiple lifetimes, which is artificial intelligence. And whether that technology will pan out to be that revolutionary, right now, there's a lot of CapEx spending. So let's discuss the right now, here and now. So CapEx, the financing for this huge build-out, Afi, are we, is that perhaps a bubble? Maybe not asset prices, but are we spending too much on CapEx, and does the market have appetite for more financing?
Well, no one really knows, precisely whether sort of supply is getting ahead of demand or whether actually it's the other way around, that just isn't enough supply and you have to continue to overbuild. But one thing is for sure is that the composition of that supply, will start to matter. And so about 18 months ago, the vast majority of that CapEx, I would say, was funded via operating cash flows. We got into a situation where today, if you believe consensus expectations, CapEx among the hyperscalers is poised to absorb the entirety of cash flows from operations. And so the reliance of debt is just a natural response to that. Once you deplete all your cash flows from operations, where you'll have to borrow or we have to go and raise capital externally, and you can do that in the debt market or in the equity market. And so I think the reliance on debt is something that will certainly persist, in my view, for at least another year and a half to 2 years. Now, I think what you need to see in order to sort of reach some kind of an equilibrium in terms of spread levels, I think the market needs to get a little bit more comfortable with some kind of a landing zone, essentially, for CapEx. Because here's how you should think about it, which is, we're in the situation where there's almost like a one-on-one mapping between CapEx and issuance. Look, every time analysts revise their estimates of CapEx higher, market automatically incorporates that and said, oh, actually, that means more supply down the road, right? And so you need to slow down a little bit, at least in terms of second derivative. Things need to sort of become a bit more predictable for the market to kind of see the end game and say, okay, there's going to be X billion dollars of supply coming over the next 6, 12 months. I can NPV that, and I can see, what type of premium I should demand for it. But at the moment, there's really two issues that credit investors are grappling with. One is, the magnitude of the supply, and there's certainly potential, concentration limit issues that will arise over time. And then I think the predictability of that supply is also key. I think the market needs to get a bit more comfortable with that. And in my view, we're not quite there yet. Now, there's obviously a fundamental angle to this, which is, this is more debt on balance sheet, full stop, right? He's just adding more debt. And so from an incremental standpoint, credit quality, has deteriorated and will likely continue to deteriorate. It's just mechanical. There's nothing crazy about that. But the starting level, I think, from a balance sheet quality standpoint, was remarkably strong. I mean, keep in mind that for the vast majority of the hyperscalers, they had negative net debt only 2 years ago. And so, yes, they added a lot of debt on balance sheet the last, 12 months, but with a handful of exceptions, I think there's still capacity. It's really the predictability of that supply that's actually generating, a little bit of concern. And then this idea that, there's only, unlike the equity market, where one capital structure can have, a 5-6% market cap relative to the S&P 500, that's a little bit harder to do in credit.
Do you think we're pricing this financing appropriately when you look at how investors are and where the issuance is selling and trading?
I don't know if we're pricing it appropriately, but I will say that the market is paying attention. And that's, to me, a really interesting difference, and a good one, actually, between ongoing AI infrastructure build-out and the fiber sort of boom and bust in the late 1990s, it feels to me that the market is a lot more rational and a lot more disciplined this time around relative to late 1990s. And so you just look at two things. I mean, look at the performance of big tech in the equity market relative to the S&P 500. It's been sort of quasi-flat, very much dispersed. The market is always trying to do the work and identify winners and losers. And so it's not treating them as like one sort of homogeneous group. So certainly a lot of dispersion, but as a basket, it's not like the market has been blindly rewarding, CapEx announcements. And then you see the same thing in credit. Look, hyperscaler spreads have been widening. I mean,
that's what I was going to ask. Yeah.
They trade wider than the index. And then if you do things even more carefully and then literally zoom in on the back end of the curve and look at sort of that incremental excess spread of 30-year bonds versus 10-year bonds, what you see is that, hyperscaler curves have been steepening. And so the market is demanding an extra premium to fund, a 30-year bond, while for the rest of the non-financial universe, it's been the opposite. It's been flattening. So the point is, I don't have a perfect answer to your question, which is the market sort of appropriately pricing this? I think we'll know in a year, but the market is paying attention.
It's
I mean,
paying
it doesn't
attention. Yeah.
mean the market is complacent.
So the market is paying attention. Is there a little bit of indigestion? That was going to be my next question, because you are seeing spreads widening. You are seeing some a little bit of volatility. For a while, it seemed like that's all they wanted. We just wanted, AI data center financing, and now perhaps less so. And there's also seem to be concern about the way revenue and spending and whether how much legs these companies will have. Some firms are already capping out on their tokens.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's definitely two sides to that equation. One is fundamentals, and it reflects all the reasons that you just went through. The other one is technical in nature, which is there's some indigestion, as you say, no doubt about it. And I think there's some concern that you may have pushed things a little bit too far. Most investors do have concentration limits at the issuer level, but I think the best illustration as to why there's that technical element, I think, to the widening that we've seen recently. Now we're lucky enough that we can have, we can observe price action in two different currencies. You may remember that, a lot of these hyperscalers issued non-dollar denominated bonds. They went to the euro market, sterling, Swiss franc, Canadian dollar, et cetera. So you can compare sort of the performance of some of these multi-currency capital structures and infer how much is sort of fundamentally driven in terms of the widening versus technically driven. One thing that caught my attention actually last week is if you look at the performance of two large hyperscalers in the euro market, it's been actually a lot more muted in terms of spread widening than in the dollar market.
Oh,
And
wow,
to me,
that's interesting.
it sort of confirms the view that yes, you can perfectly tell a fundamental story, but I think technicals also played a big role.
So maybe there's just too many dollar bonds. So there's a little bit of.
Which is why these issuers are going to non-dollar markets to begin with.
And so how much, and then just going forward in the future, you expect more volatility, you expect things to settle, you expect the appetite to resume, or there's going to be a little bit, is this sort of a reassessment that's going to linger on?
I think, look, tactically or in the near term, this is a little bit of a learning curve, for both the market and issuers. And so if you make the pipeline a bit more predictable, I think that should dampen volatility and it should avoid some of the moves that we've seen, the last week and a half. But that's sort of, to me, that's almost like a sideshow. I think that the more important question is, it's the build-out of AI infrastructure versus adoption and monetization, right? That's really the tension here because the build-out happens at time zero. You need to spend a lot of capital in order to create that infrastructure. And what you need to hope for is that adoption doesn't take too long, essentially materials, right? And so the timing sort of between the two is what will determine where we're going to settle eventually in terms of levels of risk premiums. But the bull case is that we get broader, faster adoption, and that kind of creates a little bit of a virtual circle where the hyperscalers spend, but they're in a position to monetize all that spending. And I think that will reduce a lot of the anxiety. And then the bear case would be there's a significant lag between the two, and you only get adoption, you know, much later. And then that raises the risk that you overbuild, essentially, yeah. and that you end up with a lot of excess capacity. That's kind of what happened in the late 1990s. And so that doesn't dispute the fact that, you know, this is a fantastic technology. And so the thesis doesn't change, in my view. It's the investment thesis, I think, that will look different depending on how much of a lag in timing you have between, you know, the build out and the adoption. But what you want is that you want both to happen simultaneously a little bit so that, you know, the spenders are in a position to sort of monetize the gains.
So, Lafayette, when you're looking, I know it's early days, what do you think? Any thoughts about which where we're going to be, when adoption and when will take place?
And again, like, you know, there's significant uncertainty. I'll be perfectly blunt. But I think, look, on the one hand, I think you can argue that, you know, the way sort of the economic rent of this AI sort of infrastructure build out is being distributed is uneven. Mm-hmm. And look no further than the equity market, right? Like, if you look at the performance of the entire AI ecosystem, you see massive divergence between semis and memories and then the hyperscalers. And so you're in the situation where there's one group that's spending and there's another group that's collecting the dividend from that spending. You need to balance things a little bit. And how you balance things is by accelerating adoption. Now, where does adoption come from? It comes from us, the end users, you know, you, me, enterprises, et cetera. And that's really the swing factor, in my opinion, eventually, that will determine whether we're creating excess capacity or you know, whether we're actually in a situation where sort of supply is moving in tandem with future demand.
And so private credit has also been just nabbing the headlines, although a little bit less now. And Lafayette, when I talked to you, when I read some of the research you've been doing, you suggest that there's going to be more distress in direct lending and private credit than in high yield bonds. I think the two markets have materially changed. So explain to me your thoughts about where we are with private credit, which is very similar direct lending to leveraged loan market.
Yeah, yeah. So I by the way, I totally agree with you that relative to maybe 6 months ago, there's broader acceptance of the notion that, you know, private credit might be going through a lot of fundamental challenges, but those challenges are highly unlikely to be a threat from a systemic standpoint.
Right.
I mean, you got to remember, like, in December, you know, the conversation was, is this 2008 all over again, or is this sort of a plain vanilla garden variety type of credit, you know, credit cycle? And I think today there's broader acceptance that it's highly unlikely that this is a remake of 2008, which is a good thing. And so to me, for now, at least, it feels like that systemic debate is more or less settled. It may come back, but for now, it's settled a little bit. Now, the challenges are real. You know, they're fundamental in nature, but I can list, you know, three. One, again, stating the obvious, but the vast majority of capital structures in direct lending are floating rate in nature. You know, higher. And so you have a lot of capital structures that were built back in 2020, when rates were at zero, that kind of don't work actually in an environment where the terminal value of Fed funds rates is most likely around 3.25%, 3.5%. And so, you know, we forgot about it, but that kind of acts with a little bit of a lag. The share of software is elevated. That's sort of classic, you know, negative technology shock, but AI disruption risk is quite real there. And I think a lot of analysts, even the most experienced ones, are still trying to figure out the terminal value on those businesses, and no one really knows. And the third headwind, and it's, again, it's an obvious one, but if you take direct lending, and I should have cautioned that actually oftentimes we use direct lending and private credit interchangeably.
And they're not. Exactly.
Direct lending is a subset of private credit. Private credit is a much broader asset class, and it will continue to grow, and it still earns a place, in my view, in a multi-asset portfolio. But direct lending
direct lending, we mean the sub-investment grade segment of private credit that's for corporates, very similar to leveraged loan market. Perhaps some loans for smaller companies and the leveraged market would bear, but some just as big, right? Just as big.
Yeah, and that's actually a very important one, a very important point, because direct lending did start as an asset class where the borrower base was almost entirely concentrated in that middle market. And then you're absolutely right. Starting 2021, 2022,
Just got
I think
bigger and bigger.
direct lending managers started to write bigger checks and fund companies that would normally go to the broadly syndicated loan market or the high yield bond market. But I think the more sort of basic point that I would make is that that asset class grew by a 7x factor in 10 years. This is corporate credit, right? Like, if you grow something by 7x over 10 years, well, guess what will happen is that you'll have basically underwriting standards that will become a little looser, and you're going to start to deploy that capital in situations that you shouldn't have been. And so I think some of the pressure and the stress we're seeing is just a reflection of a little bit of an imbalance, too much capital, not enough.
JCF, we're talking about a lot of worries. And yet when you look at spreads, it is so tight. So Lafri, why is it so tight? And when spreads are this tight, where do you find value?
Yes, spreads are tight, but to be honest, I think you should almost look at spreads as a little bit of a binary variable. Spreads are tight when macro fundamentals look solid, and when you don't really have a sector story that's big enough to inflict pressure on the broader market. Example would be what we had with the share revolution back in 14, 15 in the high end bond market. And so all of a sudden you reprice like a big sector. And none of that is present today, at least when I look at the bond market. So yes, valuations are uninspiring at the index level. Everywhere you look, you're either at all-time tights or not too far from the all-time tights. So how do you create value, or how do you unlock value in portfolios in a world like that? Well, I would say, number one, the good news is that even though index spreads are tight, dispersion is actually quite elevated. And so this is a market that, in my opinion, is rewarding you to do the credit work, right? And so whether that means actually spending your time looking at the left tail or downside risk, we're trying to look at things that are mispriced, but there's enough dispersion at the single name level to, I think, unlock value. And then I think, there's pockets of fixed income outside of the US that do look, quite
Ooh,
well.
tell us where.
Well, emerging markets is a good example, right? Whether you look at the, local rates or EM credit, the current EM universe is significantly stronger from a fundamental standpoint relative to, say, 20 years ago. And so many of the external vulnerabilities that were present in the EM world, 15, 20 years ago, are just not there today. And so speaking about, we spoke earlier about sort of the resilience of corporate America and the economy in the face of these rolling shocks and the situation in the Middle East. I would say actually the more surprising development of the first half of the year has been the resilience of EM in the face of these challenges. I mean, who would have thought that EM assets would behave the way they did, given sort of rising oil prices, a stronger dollar, and sort of the left tail of a full-blown sort of supply shock in commodities markets. But here we are. I think if you look at local rates or credit, they've performed very, very well, and for good reasons, in my view. And so that's been, looking for international diversification, I think, in fixed income portfolios is something that will likely continue to be rewarding here.
And particular regions, Lafri, that you like over others?
I mean, some of the jurisdictions where policy still has room to ease a little bit are usually what we look for. And the likes of Brazil, South Africa are two good examples. Obviously commodities exporting economies, so that sort of help in the current backdrop, and then the ability to sort of steepen those curves and deliver cuts.
And like right now, outside of some little bit of credit stress in direct lending and maybe in leveraged loans, the economy is doing so well. So what is your worry? Is it inflation? Is it just the Iran war continuing on? Or is it something else that we have yet to discuss that keeps you up?
I worry less about sort of the risk of inflation acceleration, and That's, again, that's a conversation
Mm-hmm.
that I have all the time with market participants. I think the trauma of that 2022 experience is still there. When inflation, both central bankers
And sharper than anyone expected, right? Yeah, it just went.
Yeah. And that, obviously, it sort of, it fueled I'll call it like a double whammy, basically, of high yields and lower risk assets. And so I worry a lot less about that today. That doesn't mean that the risk is zero. The risk is, of course, never zero. But I do think that the current backdrop is very different from 2022.
Okay.
I think the economy as a whole is a lot better balanced today. So the level of aggregate demand has actually cooled down, quite significantly. And then I think the other huge difference is the starting level of, intermediate long dated yields and policy rates is really not the same. I mean, like back then rates were at zero. And so there was this negative asymmetry, I think, for investors that's just not there today in by you. Now, to me, the biggest risk, I think, for both markets and the economy is still an abrupt end to this, AI CapEx cycle, so call it like winter. I think, in the near to medium term, that risk is fairly low, but, that would be my top risk because, if you have an unwind of the CapEx cycle, then you're going to tighten financial conditions, bad news for equities. And, there are wealth effects and other things that will, probably affect the broader economy. But that would be the biggest risk in my view. Now, the good news is that there are ways to hedge that risk.
Okay, and how would you hedge that? Because there are little inklings that are there that are happening, like just with like sometimes some of the AI companies selling off in Korea have results in huge responses here. So how do you hedge it? Because it's not, as you pointed out, not a non-zero risk.
Yeah, no, it's not. And it never is. There's no such thing as like a left-hand risk that has a zero probability. There's something. There's always a state of the world in which things kind of go south a little bit. But how would I hedge? I think, the value proposition of duration from a hedging standpoint in a multi-asset portfolio is still pretty much intact. And so you're being paid. I mean, I'll take 10-year nominal treasury yields as an example, but you're being paid 4.5 cents, give or take something, which is pretty good income, at least by the standards of the last 20 years. And I think in a state of the world where you have a negative shock, doesn't matter what that shock is, I think that the correlation between yields and risk assets will behave exactly the way it's done in the past, and it would flip negative. And so you're getting a pretty decent embedded protection by owning high quality fixed income in a multi-asset portfolio today. Now, the counter argument that we hear all the time is, well, look at the budget situation. We got 6-7%
budget
deficit. Never happened outside of war. We have a new Fed management and no forward guidance. And so there's a lot of things that you can point to that probably imply some kind of a floor, basically, on both, front end volatility and yields. And I don't disagree with that. But from a purely cyclical standpoint, if you have a growth shock tomorrow, growth shocks are growth shocks. They're disinflationary in nature. They widen the output gap and they tend to be supportive for duration. And so, the Fed is sitting on 300 basis points of cut, roughly, that they can deliver if things go, go badly. And so I do think that duration is, and high quality fixed income is probably your most effective edge. I mean, I'll take investment grade credit as an example. Spreads are around 72-74 basis points as we're recording this. And all in yields are probably around 5.5, give or take something, right? And so if tomorrow you push IG spreads wider by 70 basis points, which is quite draconian, right? Like you got to double that basically in terms of levels because of a growth shock. My best guess is that 70 basis points of widening will be probably entirely absorbed by lower yields. And so the bar is very, very high to derail total returns on high quality fixed income. And that's something we haven't seen in a very long time.
Oh, really?
Actually,
okay.
If you started to follow markets in 2010, I don't think you're fully realizing how much the the math has changed in terms of the support that Duration is providing you today.
Thank you so much. And will you please come back? Because the market's changing all the time, and I love getting your insights.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
And to our audience, thank you so much for joining us. We're now on YouTube. Please subscribe and watch and listen. And also do follow us on Spotify and Apple. And till next week, this has been Lisa Lee. Thank you.